Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yo, technology. What is it all about?
And then there's this like new startup age in aviation that we haven't really seen before, right? It's hit almost every other industry, but there's not like a lot of startup aerospace companies.
Yeah.
And so now here's a chance to do that.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from behind the scenes and inside the minds of the top people in tech. I'm your host, Danny Fortson, the West Coast correspondent for the Sunday Times. How are you all? Guys, I'm just days away from holiday. Days. Very soon, I'll be sitting poolside drinking some rum-based concoction, I hope. So I will be off next week, but that does not mean there will not be a show. In fact, we have a fabulous one coming for you next week. And all I will say is that it will blow your mind. Literally. That's a hint. But I will say no more. And anyhow, this week, we are talking about something else entirely. Air taxis. That's right. Flying cars. So longtime listeners will know that this is an area of fascination for me. We've had Mark Moore on a couple years back. He ran Uber Elevate, which was their air taxi kind of division that Uber later got rid of. We had Daniel Weigand, who's the founder of Lilium in Germany. They've created a pretty cool looking flying car, air taxi, whatever you want to call it. Point is, it's been a sector where there's just been a ton of investment. Lots of different types of aircraft have been designed and tested, but none, I repeat, none have made it to market yet. But all of a sudden, there's a whole lot happening as we get closer to that point. So Joby Aviation, they've been at this since 2009. They announced they were going public in a $6 billion SPAC reverse merger this year. We have Vertical Aerospace out of Bristol in the UK. They just announced a $2 billion plan to go public. And then we have Archer, which is based out of Palo Alto. And they just announced a nearly $4 billion reverse merger to go public on the market back in February. And I wanted to have Archer on for a few reasons. One, they're the newest competitors to the game. They're less than a couple years old. But in that time, they have designed an aircraft, announced a $1 billion order from United Airlines, and reckon that they can start air taxi services in just 3 years, 2024. That is very soon. They've already signed up two launch cities, Miami and Los Angeles. The second reason is that they're, perhaps not surprisingly, as you'll soon see, they're being sued by Wisk Aero, which is their crosstown rival. They've been working in the field for a decade. They were spun out of actually a company called Kitty Hawk, which was funded personally for years by Larry Page at Google. And they claim that Archer basically showed up on the scene, hired a bunch of their best people, and convinced them to take a bunch of files with them and copy their plane design. Now, Archer has vehemently denied this. They say the whole thing is baseless, and they're now duking it out in court. And so I want to have Archer's founders on, Brett Adcock and Adam Goldstein, to talk about just how they have got so far so quickly, when others have taken a decade or more and they now seem behind them. And now a condition of them talking is that they would not talk about the case because it's an active legal matter. But I still wanted to kind of drill into just how these two dudes with no aeronautics backgrounds have pulled this off. Not least because this also has echoes, you may be thinking, of the self-driving car race. You know, a couple years back, Google and Uber went to war in court over a company called Otto that was started by the former engineering director at Waymo, Google's self-driving car company. And there are similar charges of theft of trade secrets and all kind of jiggery-pokery. So there's that. And this is also just a glimpse into the scrum that is happening in this big new technology waterfront. There's huge potential upside, you know, potentially world-changing potential. Very high stakes, and lots of companies scrambling for the prize. Now, I am not passing judgment one way or the other on the legal case. There's still evidence being collected. It's far too early. But I just think this is a really fascinating look at an industry that is, pardon the pun, about to take off. So last week, I drove down to Archer's HQ in Palo Alto to see the plane in question and to sit down with founders Brett Adcock and Adam Goldstein to talk about this wild ride that they've been on.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thanks. Nice to meet
nice
you.
Nice to meet you.
What'd you think?
Pretty cool.
Pretty cool. And it's in pieces now, obviously.
Was this what was in the theater? Or
yeah.
The,
mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah, so it was fully assembled here, and then they had to take it all down, drive it down to LA in like a million crates,
right?
Reassemble it, and then do the same thing to bring it back. So it's like they just haven't put it all back together yet, but...
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Hey, man. How are we doing?
All right, how are you?
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right, I'll leave you guys to it.
All right.
You want anything, water?
So this is very exciting because pre-pandemic, I never did podcasts on Zoom because it sucks. But then I was like, actually, this isn't that bad. This actually kind of works. And now this is my second interview in person post-pandemic. So this is very exciting. So thank you for having me to your place. So I'm really interested in this world. Like I said before we started recording, we've had the guys from Lilium on. We had Mark Moore when he was back at Uber Elevate. I'd love to understand how you guys got involved because it's a really, really, really difficult technological challenge you're taking on. And so I'd love to just like understand how you've ended up where you are running. I know we don't like to call them flying cars, eVTOL company, but yeah, what's the story?
Yeah, great. Well, thanks for having us on. So Adam and I's journey started a little under 15 years ago. We met in New York and we were interested in working on kind of harder engineering problems to make the world better. And we've been building businesses together for the last 15 years now. We got excited about this space years ago. I think it's pretty clear, but throughout this next century, you know, we believe all forms of transportation will move to electric. Mm-hmm. We think it's a really just important theme in our life. And an area that we've gotten more and more excited about by looking at, you know, there's been improvements the last, you know, several decades in electric power systems. Batteries have gotten better, motors have gotten better, and you're seeing now electrify everything on the ground. So you're seeing this massive wave of almost every big car manufacturer in the world has announced massive plans to move to electric. Mm-hmm. Those same improvements have been continuing to a point where you can make basically an electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. Mm-hmm. And it's just an important enabler for us. When you move to an electric propulsion system, we feel we can build a new type of aircraft to help move people in and around cities. And, you know, we can do so in a fully sustainable manner. So what we're doing here is we're working on building an electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. And the reason we get so excited about this is we have a sustainability problem that we think we need to work on from a transportation perspective. And the second is, you know, there's a tremendous amount of people throughout the world live in cities. And, you know, we live in three dimensions and we travel every day on the ground, and it's leading to unprecedented traffic congestion and problems on the ground. And we view this new technology here that we're developing as a way to help kind of move people into the air really freely, travel fast, make people's lives better, and help people move, you know, to a fully sustainable transportation solution. So, you know, Adam and I are at this, you know, we want to be at this for the rest of our lives. It's we devoted our careers here to working on it at Archer. It's going to take a long time for us to have a meaningful impact on the world.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, we think one of the best teams in the world here supporting us, and some great investors and partners. And we feel really well equipped here to hopefully build a great business.
But before you did this, you guys were in a completely different world, correct?
Yeah. So when Brett and I started building businesses together, You know, we were really entrepreneurs at heart solving problems. And we started in software and we built a bunch of different things together. And we failed a lot. And it taught us a lot of lessons in terms of what it takes and what makes a business work and what a good business looks like. And also helped us really hone in on businesses that we wanted to spend our careers on. Mm-hmm. And so the last business that we built was called Vettery. It was a mission-driven business. We were helping people find jobs that they loved. And it had a really nice message to its core, really hard problems to solve. And we had a great experience scaling that team and learning how to manage kind of big teams. But, you know, we had this big thesis around electrification of transportation. And so we wanted to figure out, you know, is this the right point in history where the key enabling technologies were advanced enough to actually build and fly economically viable missions? So, you know, can we use batteries that exist today and electric motors that exist today and fly people on these missions that we think they're going to want to fly? We call it like a 30-mile nominal mission, these urban air mobility routes, and do that economically. And so we spent a lot of time understanding that. And so, you know, a lot of our roots in that journey went back to the University of Florida, where Brett and I both went to school. We set up an eVTOL lab there. And that lab was started off of Archer Road, which is the main road that goes through Gainesville, Florida. And so everyone called it the Archer Lab. That's, yeah, we'll go to the, you know, go to the Archer Lab, and which ultimately, obviously, you know, the name of the company comes from. And so we started experimenting and building planes in all different types of configurations designs.
Hold on. So you have a recruiting company.
Software business.
Software-based recruiting company. When did you sell that?
So, you know, we launched the business and, you know, we came to an agreement with a company called the Adecco Group in 2017.
Yeah, big European.
And ultimately sold it in 2018.
So you sold it in 2018.
Yeah. I think the deal closed like the first month of 2018.
Right. So you're like, okay, cool. We've just spent years in this world of software-based recruiting. Let's build an electric plane.
Yeah. I mean, look, Brett and I have been, I think, building all different types of products. I mean, we built e-commerce platforms, mobile application platforms, kind of things that really range the gamut.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we started building things in hardware, you know, it was a space that we thought could have just a much larger impact on society than a lot of the stuff that we were doing. It was also a lot of fun. Hardware is really fun because you actually can see and touch and feel and hear your product rather
than something. Hardware is also hard, as they famously say.
It is hard, but everything's hard. And yeah. So we didn't look at it as, man, which one's the easiest? We looked at it as, you know, what can we build that where we can have the largest impact, where we can build a really large company and we could do, you know, the most to impact, you know, society in a positive way.
And like, as I mentioned, we had Mark Moore on, who I believe now is an advisor for you guys, but this is when he was at Uber Elevate, and he's, you know, he's been at this for 30 years trying to do this. And if you look at, there's a whole universe of companies now trying to do this, create kind of electric takeoff and landing, ultimately autonomous vehicles to get around traffic and all kinds of things. But if you look at them, the kind of form factor, if you will, they're all over the map. It feels like it's kind of in this phase where people are still trying to figure out, okay, what's the best way to build a flying taxi? And so it's just, I'm curious because like most people, especially if you've had success, would be like, well, I'll just do something-ish in the same world. Do either or both of you have some deep interest in aviation, or like, how did you end up being like, you know, we're going to take on this massively difficult problem where the experts in the field still haven't even figured out, okay, we've kind of figured out the basics here. We know what we're going. And there's a clear path to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question. I think a few things are important to touch on here. The first is the window of opportunity to build this is really happening now on the back of electric propulsion. What we're doing here would not really have been possible before 10, 20 years ago, just because battery energy density wasn't good enough to have enough energy to make these missions work in the vehicle. You know, I think what important to make sure this works in a big way across cities, we have to make it low cost and low noise and right. high safety. And when you make the move from, say, piston engines to electric propulsion, you get to redesign a new type of aircraft from mm-hmm. scratch. And I think that for us is really important. You touched on this. There's a lot of different aircrafts that look like a lot yeah. differently. And
like flying hair dryers and everything else. I mean, it's all over the place.
All over the place. Yeah. So I think for us, we really take a step back and, you know, I like to look at everything here in first principles and first order and say, okay, we need to ultimately build a new type of service that can fit in and around cities and move people around really freely. In order to do that, being able to vertical take off and land is important. So we don't mm-hmm. have to drive to an airport and lose time. We need to be fully sustainable, which means, you know, we need to be fully battery powered and utilize electric propulsion for that. And then we ultimately need to have enough performance out of the aircraft where we can do a lot of trips per day. So it doesn't really help us if we can fly somewhere and have to charge for a long period of time or only can take a certain amount of, you know, one or two passengers. We want to move a decent amount of folks off the ground into the air. So from a physics perspective, we look at the problem and say, okay, we have a certain amount of total mass that we need to build the aircraft with. A certain of that mass will be made up of fuel or batteries. In this case, we'll have a battery mass fraction. And then of that battery, we only have a certain amount of energy on board to do, you know, your takeoff and landings, your hover, you know, mission, and then our cruise mission. And I think important to that for us here is we lower the power consumption in that equation as much as possible, which means we need to have as much disk area in the aircraft as mm-hmm. takeoff and landing. So we have as low power as possible. And then in cruise flight, we can cruise effectively in low power conditions. So that pushed us here to having 12 electric motors for both redundancy and also for hover performance, and also pushed us to a fixed wing or high aspect ratio wing aircraft in order to basically have high aerodynamic performance in the air.
Right.
And you know, that pushed us to a design that we think is one of the most ideal in the space. It relates to this design space of, you know, noise, making sure it's super low over cities. It's safe, so we have redundancy in the aircraft system, which is important here. Low cost, so moving to electric will help make that big step change in cost, but also, you know, making sure the passenger experience there is really there, so we can take enough passengers every single day. So I think from our perspective, we think there needed to be a group here that brought the right vehicle engineering solution here to the world in order to make sure that this could be a reliable service that highly utilized for a mass market transportation solution. So Adam and I believed that, you know, we were the right team to go do this, and we've assembled.
I'm not, but it's a huge prize and it's really, really difficult.
Really difficult, yeah.
And I mean, you don't have the kind of, and you're coming up from a software background.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a big thing to bite off.
I think the way maybe we'll look at it is say, just because something is so difficult doesn't mean so nobody should do it. I think I think we went into this understanding that there was low chances of success of building this business, but like, this was important to make happen. Right. This needs to happen, right? There's not a future where this shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
And you know, the way we view it is we have to get the vehicle engineering stuff right. Like, in order to, the technology has to work and make it work. And we're demonstrating that every day out here, and we'll be demonstrating it more and more to the world over the next several years. So technology is really here. We put together what we believe is the best team in the space across, you know, like eVTOL design, certification, manufacturing, just the supply chain across the board here. We have what we believe to be the kind of the, you know, the best team we could have assembled possibly. And then we have some great partners along the side. You know, we announced earlier this year United by about $1 to $1.5 billion worth of aircraft. And then we have, you know, announced earlier this year our intentions to go public through a SPAC, which gives us the balance sheet we need to make this happen. So, you know, those are all like important to make sure they line up in a nice Venn diagram to make sure you can make this happen. Yeah. It doesn't mean it will for sure happen, but I think we have the right recipe on the table to go out and make a real attempt to build what we think is going to be a really important business.
So if we go back to Florida, to the Archer Lab, so did you set up this lab with your own funds, I would guess, post the sale of Vettery?
Yeah, so Brett and I actually made a donation to the University of Florida, and we funded the research. And so, you know, our thought process here was we wanted to provide a way for the research to be done, but also in a way that advances, you know, the academic benefits of the school and the students, and, you know, one day provide ourselves with a really nice pipeline of talent. And, you know, the industry to date has largely been pretty R&D based and pretty academic in nature.
Yeah.
And so one of our differentiators in setting up the business was we started the business with a commercial approach from the very beginning. So we said, instead of what's the max you can push all this technology, meaning speed, range, and payload, what's the most, you know, what's the plane you can build to go the furthest, the fastest, carry the most payload? We didn't approach it that way. We said, okay, where do we think the biggest use case really is for this? And we think it's moving people around within these nominal missions of 30 miles. And so we said, okay, let's build a vehicle that can stay in the air for most of the day doing these 25, 30 mile trips.
And just 30 miles is that presumably is based on some kind of average commute.
Yeah. So we looked at how people are moving around, like cities in and around these kind of urban environments today. And what you'll find is that, you know, these trips of, you know, call it 25 to 30 miles can take, you know, people 60 to 120 minutes in the car.
Yes.
And I don't really see a good solution for that getting better. I think the EVs on the ground is a really good way to help with sustainability, but it doesn't help with congestion. Yeah. And so, you know, this is an alternative mode of transportation now that will allow people to still do it in a sustainable way, but also help fly above the congestion. And so these traffic patterns that you can see, and, you know, we've now built a pretty robust a system simulation kind of showing what the whole network will look like through our project called Prime Radiant, really helps us understand or helped us understand that the mission profile that we want to build for is this, you know, 30-mile mission, these urban air mobility routes. So what we did is we said, okay, now that we understand the mission profile, how do we build a vehicle that can be, you know, the most simple as possible, that can get through certification and be mass manufactured from day one? And so it was a very commercial approach to a very challenging technical problem. But when you go at it from that perspective, it's very different than going at it from the perspective of let's try to build something that can go the furthest and the fastest out there. It's just a different perspective. And I think that put us in a place where, you know, we look at our vehicle and we're really proud of it, but we also think it's the right vehicle choice for this mission. And so we think it gives us this, you know, really interesting point in the marketplace that we have a vehicle that we think we'll be able to build the most of and get through certification the fastest because it was designed that way from day one.
And so how many different iterations of the, you know, talking about the kind of different form factors, how long before you decided on this one? Because you, going back to 2018, you go, you start this lab, you start messing around, figuring out what works, what doesn't. When do you actually like form a company?
Yeah, we started working on this in 2018, and throughout 2018 and 2019, we built and flew three generations of eVTOL aircraft down at the University of Florida.
You built and flew three different...
Yeah, I mean, these were, you know, prototype aircrafts. They're five.
Did you actually get in any of these? And...
No, they were all unmanned. But right. You know, listen, we designed these ourselves from the ground up, and we really learned a lot about the, you know, the configuration choices that we were making and the physics that really happened during hover and then transitioning to cruise flight and all of that. And it was just a really incredible experience for us. And I think along that journey, we really better understood how to build the right vehicle for this. This is a really hard challenge. We're building a lot of ways, you know, power lift helicopter, we're building an airplane, we're building something with electric components in it that's relatively new for aviation. We're doing all this while having a considerable amount of software. And, you know, we have a fly-by-wire architecture. So in a lot of ways, the software will be a really large focus here internally and probably arguably the hardest thing to certify in the aircraft. So there's a big software component here. And then throughout 2019 is when we really designed from the ground up what is now the Maker aircraft and the configuration choice we have. So we've been working on that since 2019. We just unveiled a few weeks ago our Maker aircraft in LA. And as you saw, you know, earlier today, we're doing final integration there, and we'll do ground tests and bring up here very shortly. So we're excited to get that aircraft flying, learn more about the engineering choices we made across that aircraft, and, you know, largely use that aircraft as a certification test bed with the FAA, which is going to be important for us. So I think it's, listen, a natural progression for us of learning and iterating, you know what I mean? Like it's been great, but like the reality is there's a path to follow to make sure the physics work. And we have our vehicle or business level requirements that we need to meet. So we need to carry enough payload, enough passengers, enough times throughout the day to make that work. And that means using energy very thoughtfully. It means having enough like load factor or people in the aircraft during those times. And it makes sure that we can take people off the ground now that are traveling every day in cities into the air and be very thoughtful about that, right? And so we have to think, be thoughtful about where we put real estate, making sure we save people time in that journey of going to the aircraft, getting in it, taking it to where you're going, getting out, taking a car or walking or biking to where you're going. That trip needs to be shorter than a drive. And so we have to really be thoughtful about that. I mentioned here in a minute ago, our data science project called Prime Radiant, but this is like one of the most comprehensive mode choice models we know of. And that's basically taking data and trip times that are happening every single day and better understanding how to move those folks today into the air and save people a lot of time. Right. And there are millions of people like that in every city. So I think it's been a natural, you know, evolution for us. It's obviously a very challenging industry that we continue to absorb and get up to speed on every single day. And we're, you know, thankful to be surrounded by some of the, we think, the best engineers here in the world that have devoted their lives to this industry, to the spaces that they're looking in, and whether it be batteries or eVTOL design or certification. So we couldn't be more proud of the team we've assembled here.
And those first few iterations you were talking about in Florida, you were saying you guys designing those yourselves. I mean, are you project managing that? Like, how do you, because I'm like, if I had to, I don't know, create an app, I don't know anything about coding, but it kind of feels like you guys are in software. You're like, let's build a plane, an electric plane. It's just like, it's quite an extraordinary leap to make, to be like, you know what, we're going to take on this massive challenge and build a company around it.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the challenge of designing these aircrafts really revolve around, you know, you have this, you know, vehicle, you have to figure out how to get into the air, you know, with these props, right? These discs that you're going to spin. And, but then you also have to fly forward on a wing and get them out of the way so they're not draggy.
Totally.
And so a lot of the early experimentation goes around, okay, we need to get a certain amount of disc area on this vehicle, meaning like if you took like a helicopter and you do a circle around that rotor, like that they call, you know, we call disc area. We have to have a similar amount of disc area on this vehicle.
Yeah.
Right. But now we have electric motors, you can scale down the motors and rotors. So you don't have to have one big one anymore. You can have multiple.
So
the question becomes, okay, well, where do you put them? And how do you align them? And what type of configuration? And so you can, you know, align them parallel to the fuselage. You can spread them out laterally across the wing. You can put them in lots of different places. And so there's a lot of experimenting that goes on with trying to figure out where to put them. And there's a lot of mistakes that we made by doing that. And you don't really know their mistakes necessarily until you build the plane and fly them and you see what all the problems that you got. So your balance there is, you need enough disc area on this vehicle, then you have to get them out of the way so they're not too draggy for you in forward flight. Which ultimately, through the iterations, you know, of what Archer to tilting some of our rotors. And so, you know, if you look at our vehicle, you know, we have 12 motors spread out laterally across the wing, of which the 6 motors in the front tilt and the 6 aft motors are stationary. And so, you know, what we've tried to do was balance complexity, meaning the more you tilt, the more things move, the more complex the vehicle is, balance that complexity with performance. So if you reuse your motor and tilt it, the same motor you use for lift as you use for cruise, you add some complexity to the system, but you have a less draggy vehicle.
So it can perform
better. So a lot of this early experimentation is figuring out how this configuration is going to look. And we made a lot of mistakes doing that. And a lot of it's guessing in the beginning. You can make some smart guesses. And then you start to study a lot of the industry and you look at what other groups have done and you try to guess why people did that. And you know, people put public stuff out there. So for example, Airbus Vahana had a tilt wing. That was a different concept versus other groups have had, you know, 2 sets of propulsion systems and, you know, other groups fully tilt everything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what we tried to do was think about this balance of performance versus complexity, find that sweet spot. And keep pushing to figure out where that is. And that's kind of how the journey really began.
And you have presumably some kind of team of aeronautics engineers helping you kind of realize the vision.
I mean, yeah, in the early days, it was Am and I, like trying to, you know, I was like the pseudo chief engineer and we were working through this stuff. And now we have.
But that's bananas. You're not an aeronautics engineer. I mean, my dad's a pilot, and I know all the kind of stuff he had to study.
Yeah, I mean, you take the step back. I mean, this is just not there's not just the aerodynamics component here.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There's the flight control software side, the avionics side. There's the structure side. There's the manufacturing side. So this is a multidisciplinary challenge here.
And, totally.
You know, we have people here today that are just experts overall in that field. But the first few years for us was a big learning curve, and getting that up there, and I think it made us stronger as founders here too, better understanding how to come up with the right solutions to the problems. And, you know, as Adam mentioned, like, we've been trying to balance this very complex design space as best we could and try to bring the correct commercial vehicle to market. And I think we've figured that out. And I think now for us is to really make sure that we can get those choices through a certification program that's really robust. And we feel best as we could possibly be going into that, which is going to be important for us. Designing around safety is our number one goal.
Yeah.
And then designing through manufacturing. Like, we need to make a lot of vehicles. Like, even if we can get certified and make the right engineering choices, if we can't make enough vehicles, this all doesn't work.
Right. Get more of The Times and The Sunday Times for less than a pound a day. Visit thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley to start your free trial. That's once again, thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley so that they know I sent you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And so did you guys, at some point, you decide on design, did you raise outside venture capital, or like, how does that work, like, in terms of the company formation and actually getting off the ground, if I can use a...
Yeah, I mean, so Adam and I were relatively fortunate in our careers. So prior to starting this, we started a software company, and we had a successful exit of that business prior to Archer. So Adam and I, for the first few years, we self-funded that whole business.
Yeah.
And it put us in a fortunate position to kind of really, you know, get a high conviction on the idea, really spend a lot of time on the project and really understand the engineering constraints and everything else. And then one of the first real person to take a real bet on us was Mark Lorry. So Mark is the founder of Jet.com, sold to Walmart.
Diapers.com as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
Diapers to Quidsy to Amazon.
How did you meet Mark Lorry?
Yeah, so we were in New York, and I actually cold emailed Mark. I just listened to one of his podcasts, and you know, Mark was talking a lot about going through the acquisition process at Amazon with diapers and his frustrations and positives. And I wrote Mark and said, you know, I'd love to grab coffee and, you know, going through a lot of the same stuff here in our acquisition and love to talk with you. And Mark immediately said, we should go grab coffee. And when we met, one of the first things I said is, like, I'm working on this new project. I think I'm going to do it for a really long time. And Mark's like, I agree with you. I want to invest in the business. I want to help you guys out.
That first coffee.
And Adam and I got to know Mark a lot better over the next several months, and Mark ended up, you know, basically leading our seed round. So Adam and I put a considerable amount of capital in with Mark, but Mark basically was the only one in our first round of capital. And, you know, even to this day, Mark's is our largest outside investor, kind of here pre-SPAC.
Oh, wow.
So he's been a tremendous asset for us, not only just coming in and helping us, you know, backstop the business and help us out in the early days, but Mark's an incredible entrepreneur that's had so much success scaling businesses up and people and everything else and recruiting. So, you know, one of our big goals last couple of years and still is today is making sure we have the right people in the organization here aligned and culturally, you know, incentivized here to really help build a great business. So Mark's been a key partner for us. along the journey, we've obviously picked up other investors that are, you know, some of which have backstopped me and Adam in prior ventures and some new. And then earlier this year, we announced we'd go public through a SPAC with Atlas Crest. And we announced the $1.1 billion capital raise. And it's an important inflection point for us where we now have enough capital to get to market, cash flow break even, and, you know, do, like you mentioned before, hardware is hard.
Yeah.
And it's not only just hard, it's very capital intensive, long timeline. So so here, you know, capital is really important for us, and we couldn't be more excited about you know, the people that backs up us along the way.
What was the process of getting, because United has invested, correct?
Yes.
And they've also agreed to be, I think, your first customer. Is that
yes.
right? Yes. So how did that come about?
Yeah. So taking this product to market, I think, involves, you know, it's complex for obvious reasons from the technology, but there's the whole operational side and the consumer acceptance side and, you know, the policy side of things when you're, you know, a new mode of transportation, especially one that flies and flies over, you know, cities. And so we really looked to, you know, position Archer in a way that could not only just have a great piece of technology, but could also gain the trust of the public and also help make us operationally, you know, really efficient. And you really learn from a lot of the safety lessons that, you know, some of these other groups out there have done. And so, you know, we talked to a bunch of different groups out there. One of the first partners that, you know, we met was Stellantis, which is the recent merger from Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot. So to form one of the largest.
That's called Stellantis. That passed me by, Stellantis.
Yeah, it's called Stellantis now.
That's a ridiculous name. But anyway.
That's... Yeah, it's the I think it's the third largest auto OEM, you know, now. It's a big company. It's a great company. And they really had this vision of understanding the, you know, multiple modes of transportation that could all go electric and the benefits that we could have by partnering with them and, you know, helping us think through, you know, our ability to mass manufacture high scale composites and figuring out how to, you know, bring our costs down as you're scaling up you know, these businesses through their supply chain. And so they were a really great partner that understood the vision where we kind of aligned with them from that perspective. And so they proved to be a really great partner. They're also an investor in the business too. And then on the other side of things where we thought about operations, we said, okay, well, you know, we really want to think about, you know, the number one priority for this business is safety. And so, you know, United Airlines brand really stands for safety. That's probably like the most important asset like that they have. You know, when you see a plane out there with a United logo, you don't say, oh, is that a A320 or what? You'd say, oh, that's a United plane. That means it's safe. And so they were a really great natural partner for us to team up with. And it also really kind of balanced both of our priorities as well. So not only is it great for us that, you know, we could learn from, you know, one of the, you know, the greatest airline out there, but also for them, there was really big benefits. So they have an agenda internally to really try to decarbonize the skies. And so it's tough to do that in a substantial way. So this was a way, one of the ways that they could do that was to partner with Archer. It was the first major significant investment in the space, like from an airline.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
and when they invested, did you guys have a plane, like a prototype built yet?
Yeah. So we were in the process of, you know, building Maker. Maker has been in, you know, different stages. And so, you know, we had different subscale versions of that and, you know, we hadn't unveiled the full scale version of that yet. But you know, that was very far along in its design process. And so, you know, we talked to them about what the product could look like and how it could help them. It also from their existing product, you know, their airline, it helps defrictionize travel for their travelers, right? So if you think about, you know, the airlines are trying to move people and if you can defrictionize travel along the way to help people get to the airport, right? If you think about flying on a plane, it's actually a pretty decent experience now.
Yeah.
But everything that leads up to that experience
sucks.
Is bad, right? The trip to the airport itself, all that's the food, all the delay, all that stuff is just brutal. But this helps, you know, kind of get rid of a lot of those problems. So it's great for their core product too. And there's a lot of other tactical things for them too that make a lot of sense. Like one other example, you know, is around like their pilots. So like, you know, as the, you know, the big pilot fleet largely comes from, you know, the military and there's not a lot of way to diversify what you get. So this is a product that they can now have in their fleet where they can attract new, younger pilots to their company that it can train on much easier to fly airplanes and grow up within the United family and really start to add diversity into their pilot pipeline. And so, you know, lots of different tactical things like that, that really aligned. So we aligned really well from a mission perspective. It helped fill our needs and it helped fill their needs. So it turned out to be-
How did you guys find each other?
So, you know, we talked to a lot of the different aerospace folks. And I think a lot of the aerospace companies are very curious about what we're doing. Everybody feels like electric could potentially shift you know, into this new golden age of aviation, and everybody's trying to figure it out. So reaching out to the airline folks, I'm not sure who reached out first in that case, but everybody's very willing to talk because everybody wants to understand what's happening. And so also, I'm not sure if you saw, United also just announced a venture fund where they're going to be investing in new, you know, you know, technology. So that, like, you just haven't seen this new wave of aviation innovation in a long time, right? So everybody is, it's on the tips of their tongues.
Right. And so what's, so we're 2021 now. We just were in your kind of, I guess, your workshop with kind of the plane in pieces and whatnot. How long will it be from going from that to seeing your planes or somebody else's flying taxis, whatever you want to call them, actually out there in the world?
Yeah, that's a good...
I know that's like a kind of an impossible question to answer because a huge part of it's a regulatory question.
But... Yeah, for sure. And listen, our roadmap was to assemble what we think is the right team, the right, you know, engineering requirements, and then build basically the full capabilities, a vehicle that can demonstrate the full capabilities of electric vertical takeoff and landing. And that's Maker for us here. And we're going to use that as a, you know, a certification test bed to help advance our key enabling technologies here internally. And we're excited to have that here. The next step for us is to bring a real certified product to market that you're talking about. And we've chose to launch here in the United States, and federally the airspace is regulated by the FAA. Yep. And we need to go through what they call a type certification process and get our type certificate for an aircraft in order to fly it. So what we are doing now is designing an aircraft, which looks almost identical to Maker in a lot of ways, with the FAA that we will introduce into the market in 2024. So our timeline here is a multi-year timeline to design around safety and demonstrate those safety benefits with the FAA in order to hit our goal of, you know, making this a reality for those city in these cities in 2024. So, you know, we're looking at 3 or so years, maybe a little over 3 years. And we are now kind of fully immersed in that whole process of going through there and designing around those requirements and showing means of compliance to those requirements. And, you know, I think it's going to be 2024 is also, you know, not very far away. It's like, so we've announced early this year, we'd partner with both Miami and LA as our first two launch cities. We like those cities in part because they're large and have a lot of traffic problems, but they also have a lot of existing real estate. So there's a lot of places to put, you know, landing sites. A lot of these cities already have a lot of helicopter landing sites and airports that we can already land on with existing infrastructure. They're very pro to bring in new technologies like this to help with, you know, transportation issues like this and sustainability. Yeah. And so we're really excited to have those two here on the docket. And we're now heads down and building, and we'll be, you know, we'll be flying every week, and we'll be, you know, keeping the public overall updated on our timeline. But you know, there's a lot to do for us, but we think it's really possible. I mean, the window of time opened up where the overall kind of key enabling technologies to make this work are matured enough, mostly around batteries and electric propulsion, those areas, and certification is here now. I think what a lot of folks don't really understand here in the US is, you know, we're certifying under Part 23, which is what, you know, the FAA certifies for airplanes today. So we're certifying similar to how an airplane is certified. And there's only a couple big differences. One is on the electric motor side, and the second is the vertical lift. We're taking off and landing vertically. But those are pretty well understood at this point. And so the FAA has rules and guidelines to certify this. They made changes in 2017 to allow for this. We have about 50 people at FAA working on our project, and we're, you know, every week, every day talking to the FAA and working with them on designing that aircraft for a certified product.
Right. And so does that vehicle in there, does, I mean, obviously not right now, but has that flown? Does that fly?
So yeah, actually a lot of people at the event were like, that's not the real vehicle, right? That will fly. And, it actually is the real vehicle that will fly. It's the same one. What we're doing now is the work in order to get it to fly safely. And what we're doing here is we're doing final integration. We'll do bring up and ground testing, and then we'll start first hover flights later this year. We'll first start by...
So it hasn't come off the ground yet.
Hasn't come off the ground yet. Right. Yeah. I mean, what we'll do is a multi-month process for integration and testing and work to make sure we have the safest flight test program possible. We'll start with just hover flights, and then we'll slowly transition the vehicle to forward flight and expanding the flight envelope from there. So it'll be, you know, we'll be flying every single day of that vehicle, and it'll be important. I mean, we're going to learn a lot about the configuration choices we made and the engineering choices and system architectures and component decisions, but we're starting the work now to gear up to be flying every single day.
And how difficult is it to get talent, because, you know, as you say, you need a certain type of skill to be able to build these things. And all of a sudden, when we had Mark Moore on a couple of years ago, he's like, this is like a new Kitty Hawk era. Like, there's dozens of companies working on the same problem now, and there's only so many people who can do it. And I know, I mean, we're not going to talk about the lawsuit, but you guys are being sued by Wescaro, et cetera, because a lot of those people who were there are now here. But is it hard to find the people to work on this?
Well, I think what's challenging is that there's a new type of engineer that's kind of been born, right? Like Brett mentioned, you know, you need rotorcraft people that understand vertical lift. You need, you know, people that understand fixed wing aircraft, and you need people that understand big electric, you know, components. So I think that's what's challenging. And so there are a couple companies that had previously, you know, over the last decade had been working on, you know, in this industry. So there were some of those engineers. And so, you know, for example, Tom Yunez and Jeff Bauer, our COO and chief engineer, you know, have been working in this space for a long time, you know, almost a decade.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those two guys coming to Archer, I think, was a pretty big deal in the industry, because that was two guys, you know, one that was, you know, senior guy running one program, the other one, senior guy running another program, coming together to say, hey, we think we can actually commercialize a vehicle here. Mm. And if anybody in the industry is interested in doing that, come join us. And so, you know, there was a really big sort of, I'll call it like signaling effect to the world that, wow, these are two like well-known people coming together in the industry. And so the ball started rolling from there. Mm. And so it's definitely hard to attract people in general to, you know, to the industry, but this is the most exciting thing happening in aerospace. It is really exciting. Good. So pretty much all of the aerospace engineers are fascinated by what's going on here. And so I think a lot of the, you know, the industry players look back and say, okay, you know, I come out of college, I can go work on, there's some, you know, traditional helicopters, or go work at, you know, Boeing, or go work at Airbus. And then there's this like new startup age in aviation that we haven't really seen before, right? It's hit almost every other industry, but there's not like a lot of startup aerospace companies.
Yeah.
And so now here's a chance to do that. And so these are young, fun companies that are, you know, just different. And so I think that's actually helped attract a lot of talent in general now within the industry to these companies, to these eVTOL companies. And then of course, there's always the competition between the companies, and everybody has something a little bit different, you know, to offer. But I think at Archer, you know, what we've shown is that, you know, we have a pathway to getting our type certificate and getting to market. We have really strong partners. We have really great leaders. And I think that's an attractive package that people really want to come be a part of. I think we've also just taken an approach to a mission that people can believe in and get behind. Right. And there's a lot of people that have a real big belief in sustainability and sustainable forms of transportation. And that, I think that's really exciting to people.
And on the launch event, why do it now? Because, and the reason I'm asking that is because, like, I've been covering a lot of, we mentioned it before, electric vehicles. There's been a boom, just like what's happening in eVTOLs. And a lot of companies are coming out and then proving later to be like, well, we don't actually have the goods, you know, but they've gone public, raised a bunch of money, et cetera. Why not wait till you have a flying vehicle? Or, you know, I've seen a lot of videos of other companies flying over countryside or whatever. Why come out now? Was this part of the SPAC process to kind of educate the world about what is coming and what you're planning? Or why now before you have something that actually flies?
I'll give a 2-second version. I'll pass over to Brett to give his version, because I know he'll want to comment on that too. I think for, at least for me, I think we wanted to put out a foundational piece that sort of, you know, no matter where we were in a capital raising or whatever cycle that we were in, wanted to put a foundational piece out there that said, you know, hello world, here's what we're doing. Here's what we believe in. Here's the start of this, you know, public facing, you know, kind of mission. And we wanted to put that message out there. And so it was a really good opportunity for us to do that. It happens to be, you know, timing, you know, wise just because of the SPAC, but it's not related to that. It was more of our introduction, I think, to the world in a big way, where we had something we were really proud of that we'd worked really hard on, you know, for many years to show off. But Brett, I want to let Brett answer that too.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's like, all right, you don't have a vehicle, but it doesn't fly, and you're flying, but it's not a certified vehicle. And then it's certified, but it's not a mass market transportation system yet. So it's funny. We're just in this, you know, we're relatively early stage in a very important disruptive technology. So, you know, I think I just echo what Adam said. I think we wanted to get the vehicle out there. We want to tell a story what it can do. From there, we're going to be doing flight tests. We'll be working on our certified product. We'll be working through manufacturing. There's a lot of milestones here for us. Mm. And the goal is just to be completely transparent from the beginning and let the world just follow what we're doing. And, you know, what we set out to do is hard. We're not trying to act like it's not. And we thought the event a couple weeks ago was was a really important milestone for us to get it, to get our voice out and tell people why we're doing this. Like, why are we building electric aircraft and why it matters? And then, you know, what we think this is going to help fix and solve. And, you know, for us, we're in this forever. Like, we're in this for decades. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, it was the first big public appearance for us. There will be more, and we would love everybody to be rooting for us and maybe even helping join us for this long mission we're on how to, you know, build a new transportation service.
And why'd you guys do it in Hawthorne, of all places?
So let me give one more comment too, just sort of like almost, you know, echoing like the excitement, I think, that not just people in the industry have, that outside that industry. So that was the first big like public event like we've done like that. That event across all of our channels has over 20 million views. I mean, it just had mass appeal. And so I think the world wants this product to come. The world is really excited for it to come out there. And so, you know, that was just almost like, in our view, like evidence that the world is rooting for us. And as Brett said, you know, we want it to be transparent. So why Hawthorne? So the city of Los Angeles is, you know, one of the cities we've identified as one of our early launch cities. So we've announced LA and Miami as our two launch cities.
Yeah.
And so, you know, LA is, you know, obviously has a lot of traffic. LA has also set up, you know, specific groups to help think about new sustainable transportation solutions. So they have a really pro environment to launch there, very supportive. And so it was a city that we wanted to, you know, really kind of show it off and bring it there. You know, we talked a little bit about it in the presentation. You know, that hangar that we did it in is actually like a pretty iconic place. It's actually like the original headquarters of Jack Northrop. You know, it's a place where, you know, many early iconic aircrafts were, you know, kind of pioneered there. And so it was actually a really cool place. It was special for us. But we really wanted to make sure that, you know, we could bring, obviously COVID made, you know, the whole event challenging, but we wanted to do it in a place that was a, you know, important launch city that we were bringing the product to market with.
And just, I know we've talked a lot of kind of around it, but the actual product itself, because what I think people don't quite understand is, you know, it kind of looks funky, but this is quite different and can offer some things that, like, you know, a helicopter, for example, can't. So I don't know if there's like, if you could just briefly describe why this is a thing. What is it going to do that will surprise people, and why this is potentially, why there's so many companies trying to crack this nut?
Yeah, so the industry is at a point in time where the key enabling technologies have been advanced, meaning
batteries
and electric motors. Yeah. And largely that's a result of the autos. They've just pushed it, you know, really far, and it's enabled, you know, aerial mobility, right? Mm-hmm. So like electric aerial mobility. So you can fly these vehicles now, and, you know, all electric powered. And the benefits you get from that, which I mentioned earlier, is that you can, you know, you can scale down these motors, which you can't do with piston or combustion engines. They're just not efficient when you do that. And so you have this new category of products that are enabled, and you get three huge benefits that come out of this, and they're around cost, safety, and noise. So these electric vehicles have 70 to 80% less parts, which means lower maintenance, which means lower total cost, which means lower maintenance means higher utilization. So you can start to drive the cost, you know, dynamic in a way that becomes affordable. If you can highly utilize these vehicles, then all of a sudden, you know, they can become more affordable because you can spread out the cost over a larger group of people. So if you have an affordable product that lots of people can use, I think nobody is sitting there saying, oh, I enjoy 90 minutes of traffic. Wow, I can't wait to just sit there and do nothing, right? Yeah. I don't think anyone's saying that. So everybody wants the product, you know, to be out there. I think the second one, you know, around the safety side is because these vehicles are highly redundant, they're super different than the previous class of vehicles, you know, helicopters, which had, you know, much less, or I guess much higher safety concerns.
Yes.
So, you know, lots of single points of failure, lots of, they call critical components that are, you know, make those vehicles more dangerous. So this safety element really changes the game, where you can now certify these vehicles at similar levels to commercial airliners. And then finally is noise. So you have this ability to create a vehicle that is virtually silent while flying overhead. And so there's a lot of dynamics into, you know, why that is the case. But, you know, it's a category thing that we all benefit from, cost, safety, and noise. And it's the reason why I think we all believe that this new urban air mobility industry is going to be a large thing. And it's a benefit that I think will, again, help sustainability and help relieve congestion, you know, because of those dynamics.
So I have two questions, and I'll let you guys go. One is, so why did you guys come out here to do this? Because you were kind of East Coast based, right? Until doing your previous businesses and then in Florida. Why come out here to do this?
Yeah, I mean...
the most expensive place in America.
Yeah, it's certainly expensive. I mean, we were in New York before, and New York was expensive.
Yeah, true,
and
true.
We're like, okay, we're going to move out inside of New York. It's going to be less expensive. Yeah. And no, not really, right? So, no, I mean, like to be really upfront, we want to build a big business, and talent is really important. And we basically think we have some of the best talent in the world here in a really short period, really short distances from where we're at today. Aerospace talent, software talent, recruiting, hiring, accounting, finance, basically across the board to build a big business. And you know, the primary focus for us the next several years will be hiring, just bringing on the right people here in the organization and scaling up. And we knew that we couldn't build, you know, a next great aerospace company out of Manhattan. That doesn't make sense. And you know, being here in the Bay Area here allows us to attract, we think, some of the world's best talent and have them here. You know, over time, we'll have more locations and other areas for things like manufacturing and such. But, you know, couldn't be more excited about moving out here several years ago and assembling this team now. And, you know, I think it's just, you know, talent and bringing the right people in here has been a very strong focus for us since day one. I mean, we spend a lot of our time even just trying to bring in the right folks and making sure we can really align them and make sure we keep people happy and keep people focused. And I think, you know, this offers an ability for us to hire some of the best engineers in the world. I mean, we're close to some of the biggest, you know, companies in the world, both hardware and software being out here.
Right. Where is this built? Where is this, the plane itself built?
Where was it built?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, all over the place. Some of it here internally, but yeah. We have components, you know, all across the world.
Right.
We have done almost all the software, flight control software and other various software ourselves internally. We're building our own batteries and motors here now. You know, the carbon fiber composite was done with a partner of ours here on the West Coast. I think largely we're focused on, for the aircraft, of really owning the key enabling technologies. And that for us is vehicle design, the work there, software, both on flight controls and avionics, electric propulsion and electric power systems. So basically batteries, electric motors, and manufacturing and simulation. Those are areas that we really focus a lot of time on and spend a lot of internal focus on making sure we do really well, because we think it'll be important long-term for us to basically make big strides in those areas.
And lastly, if we get a crystal ball out, let's go to 2030, Miami in 2030, or let's LA, because I know LA, I have friends there and I know what the traffic's like. What does LA look like in 2030 in terms of what you guys are doing there?
Yeah, well, it would be wonderful to say that there are tens of thousands of vehicles flying around carrying everybody, but I think there will certainly be an adoption period, you know, that takes place. And so a lot of that will just be simply the limitations of groups like Archer and our ability to produce aircraft. So, you know, when we look today, you know, we see LA has, you know, 50 million daily trips, of which 5 million take longer than an hour in a car. And so you have 5 million people that are driving an hour. It's brutal, right? So what percent of those could we move to the air where they can fly in, you know, these routes that are 5 to 10 minutes? And the answer is probably a decent amount of those. Now, you know, what we're hopeful, you know, is that there'll be a product that's available to as many of those people as possible, where we can, you know, start to change the way people think about, you know, living and commuting, and hopefully change the way that society really, you know, operates. Like you don't have to live in a certain place anymore if you can commute there in 5 minutes.
Yep.
The reason why we live where we live generally has to do with closeness to society. The same thing with our ability to explore. And so, you know, 20 miles outside of LA is just some incredible landscapes. But, you know, we generally don't go out into the desert and do stuff out there because, you know, it takes a while to get out there and there's not a lot of infrastructure built out there. But imagine if there was. And so, you know, we like to think about a world where there's really incredible experiences that lots of people can go out and enjoy and explore that go beyond just commuting, that go beyond, you know, stuff that's like daily grind kind of stuff, and enable these exploration trips that will just help people like enjoy life more, make life more fun. And I think that's what the product can do that goes beyond commuting. And that's like what we get excited about. And that's what we really try to push the brand on, is that, you know, that these vehicles can be used, you know, to really just enhance life outside of just pure commuting trips.
Did either of you envision building a plane or building a plane company when you were kids?
Doesn't everybody?
I didn't. And my dad's a pilot, but I don't know. Was that like a thing for either of you?
I think for me, you know, the way I've thought about you know, just things in general is I actually think most things are hard. I think like, you know, waiting tables is hard, painting houses is hard, building software is hard, building hardware is hard. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to do it, make it count. And right. So this was an ambitious project that we could sink our teeth into, dedicate our lives, dedicate our careers to it, and have a big impact in society. And so I think it's something that, you know, once we understood what was possible, once we kind of tasted that, there was no turning back.
Right. Same for you?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think, you know, what's one thing working on hard problems to make the world better? Like that's, I think it's important, but also like, I think it's important to be waking up to a world that's exciting and inspiring. And, we have a chance to go do that here, right? We have the right team and capital and partners, and it's just an unbelievable adventure. So yeah, we wake up every day super excited about what we're doing, and it's, I think it's a future we all want to happen. So yeah. Let's go do it.
Amen. Well, I wish you luck. Thank you guys for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have. I want to thank Brett and Adam for taking the time to sit down. And thank you all for listening as ever, for giving all those glorious ratings and reviews, and every once in a while those nice little tips in the Acast tip jar, which are always gratefully received. And that is it. Like I said, I am not writing for the paper next week, but I am podding. So expect your normal service. We've got a really interesting, fun one for you. So do keep your eye out for that. And in the meantime, you know, maybe I don't have to say stay safe, stay sane anymore, but I still will. Stay safe, stay sane. We're not out of the woods yet, but we're getting there. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye. Want more out of this podcast? Go to thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley to read articles based on these interviews, broader discussions of the topics covered here, and of course, the amazing work of all my colleagues across the rest of the paper, all for less than £1 a day. Start your free trial now by going to thetimes.co.uk/Danny in the Valley.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.